Batman and Mr. Miracle. Welcome to FW Team Up, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Chris Franklin.
Taking you through a classic superhero team up, Batman and Mr. Miracle from The Brave and the Bold number 112, cover dated May 1974. And Chris, this is a mere 2 months since Mr. Miracle series was canceled.
I thought these books were supposed to help sales. You think they would have put this out before they canceled the series to possibly goose sales? But maybe that was the plan, but the axe came down earlier than anticipated. This is during the Carmine Infantino era where he just willy-nilly canceled things. So
right, especially Kirby's stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he was assured that he would be like in control, like his own editor and in control of his books. And all of the Fourth World books had been axed before this point.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Miracle was the last holdout. At that point, maybe Kirby just went like, okay, now I'm ending it. Maybe it was his decision to end it because divorced from the Fourth World, it just didn't make sense to him anymore.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, you do have a feeling from reading what was happening back then that he's sort of discouraged with his deal with DC and Infantino in particular. The way he was treated there.
Yeah. He left to be treated better and then ended up getting probably treated worse in the end. So, yeah.
Yeah. So this one, it does take place before the final issue. You're right. Like, there's like a new status quo or like a, there's a true ending to Mr. Miracle number 18 or whatever that makes him leave Earth. So this is going to be like just before that, I guess. So you're right. It probably was planned beforehand. Okay, let's preface with reasons why we like this guest character. What's so great about Mr. Miracle?
I think it's that never give up spirit, which is why certain modern creators' version of the character just doesn't vibe with me, doesn't jive. No matter how many awards they got, I'm sorry. I saw the first few pages of that and said, nope, that's not for me. Go make your own characters to deconstruct, but I'll get off my soapbox. Plus, Bard and Oberon are great characters on their own, so this found family is just a lot of fun. And I first encountered him in the JLA-JSA New Gods crossover in Justice League, and then didn't really see him again until the Superpowers third series figure, which I was lucky to get because those were hard to find. Then, of course, I followed him into JLI, which, of course, Shaq covers on the Blahaha podcast, and into a spinoff series briefly, but I didn't stick around on that one too long. But, yeah, but I was a fan. And the Who's Who pages, of course, all the Who's Who pages.
I'm a big Kirby fan, as I've said before, you know, especially in this era, the early 70s, the 70s. I subscribe to the idea that the Fourth World is an attempt at recreating myth and therefore religion, but using comic book tropes. So the New Gods are an attempt at doing, you know, pagan faiths, Greeks, you know, well, actually it was supposed to be Tales of Asgard, right? It's kind of
right.
That game plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Forever People are the New Age stuff, you know, the hippie outlook. And then Mr. Miracle was the New Testament. It has a Christ figure who escapes the crucifixion and teaches the religion of freedom. As in artistic freedom, because that's what Kirby was himself preaching. Like, don't emulate my style, find your own style. And that was always kind of his thing when dealing with other artists. And opposed to Darkseid's anti-life equation, which is anti-freedom. So there's a lot more going on here than just like super escape artist for me. And it makes Scott Free the very best of the Fourth World heroes, hands down.
Yeah. I like it. Yeah. And I'm a big Kirby fan too, but I didn't get to read these books until I got the mega Chaka Car omnibus that come out a few years back, you know? So
I read the Fourth World and like those Fourth World omnibi, there's like four of them. That's where I sort of discovered it for real, even though obviously I like the character in JLI and other appearances that I'd seen. That's what cemented it for me. And so let's talk about Mr. Miracle's publication history then. I believe it's my turn to give us the rundown on the guest character. I chose this issue. So as I mentioned, Jack Kirby created Scott Free. First appearance, Mr. Miracle number 1, April 1971. The longest lasting book of the Fourth World series, though Kirby was asked to take the Fourth World stuff out of the last few issues. It ends with issue 18, which has Scott and Big Barda marry and then leave for New Genesis. After three appearances in The Brave and the Bold, his book is revived in September of 1977 by Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers, then Steve Gerber and Michael Golden, with the series getting imploded with issue 25 the next year, turning him once again into other people's occasional guest star. In 1987, he was made a member of Justice League International, as we've said, which leads to a one-shot special by former Kirby assistant Mark Evanier, who unofficially co-plotted a lot of the original series, and artist Steve Rude, and then an ongoing series that began in January 1989, written by Jam DeMatteis and initially drawn by Ian Gibson. It lasts 28 issues and ends in 1991. In 96, Kevin Dooley writes a series in which Scott attempts to escape his destiny as a new god by working for a charitable foundation in New York, but it's canceled after 7 issues to make room for Jack Kirby's Fourth World by John Byrne. And that series makes him replace Highfather as the leader of New Genesis. Death of the New Gods kills Big Barda, makes Mr. Miracle unstable, and he dies at the Source Wall after betraying every principle he ever had. And people wonder why I hate Jim Starlin's DC work. Early 2010s, the New 52 had Mr. Miracle, simply called Scott with one T, dumb, becoming a hero on Earth 2. In 2017, Tom King, it goes from bad to worse, writes a 12-issue miniseries about Mr. Miracle, which, I mean, sight unseen, I'm sure Scott is completely out of character. In animation, he's been on Justice League Unlimited, The Brave and the Bold, and Justice League Action, among other things. I am not mentioning here the various series headed by Shiloh Norman, Scott Free's successor, but he was often the Mr. Miracle of the new millennium, Seven Soldiers, The Source of Freedom, that's all Shiloh.
Right, yeah, too bad he's not in this one.
Yeah, he could have been, right? He was established in the original series, so he should have been in the crew, probably, with Oberon and Barda. Let's look at the synopsis here. This is called The Impossible Escape. It's written by Bob Haney with art by Jim Aparo. Batman, take it away.
Greetings, citizens. This is Batman, here to tell you another of my exciting adventures in crime fighting. I was attempting to help Commissioner Gordon and the GCPD stop a group of terrorists from entering the recently installed Mastaba at the Gotham Art Museum. After using a shotgun to fire off some tear gas, my bat sense alerted me to danger. The deluded criminals had blown themselves up. Inside, museum curator Carlton French speculated the terrorists were after the bat statue of Hotep, whose hieroglyphics were said to point to the secret tomb of Aten, the first pharaoh of Egypt. The Egyptians believed Aten had unlocked the mysteries of immortality and buried his secrets there before disappearing. French translated the glyphs to read, "He who finds mighty Aten's tomb, where the bat marks high noon, will find everlasting life." Our discussion was interrupted by the arrival of Inspector Saeed from the Egyptian National Police. He claimed the museum's purchase and relocation of the Mastaba was illegal. After conferring with the U.S. and Egyptian governments, naturally, I agreed to fly to Egypt and settle the matter. It's just part of the job when you are a duly deputized agent of the law. French suggested while I was there, I should look into the mystery of Aten's supposed tomb.
Cut to the Alps. A secret cabal is behind these crimes, trying to save the life of their rich master. Cut to Paris, the top of the Eiffel Tower. Mr. Miracle will attempt a daring escape during a raging thunderstorm. Lightning strikes, weakening his chains as planned, and he jumps off the structure, only to meet Dr. Ingrid Borg on a lower level. She dares him to accept her mission and attempt the greatest escape of all time.
I found the man who sold the Mastaba to Gotham. Ali Farouche, dead. Inspector Saeed arrived on the grisly scene, convinced the same people who sent the man to Gotham were again trying to locate the bat statue and the information that would lead to Aten's tomb. With my only lead dead, I had no choice but to venture off on a side quest into the desert that had no bearing on Gotham's ownership of the Mastaba, in the hope of finding Aten's tomb and the men who were so desperate to find it first. My journey took me deep into the desert in a deadly sandstorm, where I was attacked at knife point, perhaps by one of those very men.
Above, Mr. Miracle and Dr. Borg are in a helicopter being tossed about like a leaf in that sandstorm. It crashes, but Scott is able to rescue Ingrid using his flight discs.
My assailant met his fate by tumbling down a dune into some rocks while I continued on. I then spotted a fantastic sight. A rock shaped like a bat. I wish I had thought of that. Pointing toward a canyon filled with water from the Nile. My timing was impeccable, as the high noon sun pointed the bat's shadow right over a secret doorway in the canyon wall. French's translation was correct. I pressed on the door and the waters pushed me inside, but the door shut behind me, with no way out. I investigated my surroundings, finding I was indeed in an ancient tomb, with a strange light glittering ahead.
Shortly, Scott and the gorgeous archaeologist find Atun's hidden tomb thanks to a rubbing of hieroglyphic directions, which also tells the tale of Atun. He was a stranger who came to the Egyptians when they were merely farmers and made them into a mighty empire. He promised the secret of everlasting life, but before they could receive it, a strange beam took him away. They put his crown and scepter in a tomb in the hopes that someday he would return. Scott and Ingrid are trapped when impregnable doors start closing, but they are soon accosted by Atun himself. Ingrid tries to ingratiate herself to him and asks for the secret of immortality, which she reveals is in his scepter, so she grabs it and runs with Scott in tow. He helps her survive a number of death traps, but then learns she's more fortune hunter than archaeologist, in the service of a master who means to cheat death with Atun's secret. She turns on Mr. Miracle and is killed by a ricochet from her own gun. Scott finds his way to the burial chamber itself, where he confronts Atun, Mother Box overcoming the control circuits in the Egyptian crown and releasing from its thrall the Batman. The Batman costume left in Atun's sarcophagus gave the game away.
Mr. Miracle fills me in on what had been happening, and we left the mind-controlling helmet behind. But now we knew that Atun did indeed exist. If that wasn't enough evidence, the very beam that took him away millennia ago appeared in the tomb and chased after us. An unmovable door mysteriously opened, and we fell into the chamber beyond. But most astonishing is the vehicle we found inside. A solar boat designed to take away the dead to the afterlife. Except this solar boat was actually capable of flight. We then deduced that the Atun was no mere earthling. I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens. The beam melted through the heavy door, and we hopped inside the solar ship and blasted out of the tomb, which was then flooded by the Nile waters. The ship and the scepter Miracle had discovered both turned to dust. Even more astonishing, Miracle assured me he was not really piloting our escape craft. Some more advanced power had taken over his advanced circuitry. The question remains, who was our mysterious benefactor?
A few days later, the master dies in the Alps. Immortality denied him. And light years away, Atun is told by his leaders that immortality was too rich a gift for the people of Earth, and he bows to their wisdom. All right, which Batman did we get this time?
Well, I was trying to do Adam West. I don't think I hit it too good today, but
It had to be him, right? Because this story is nuts in a 1966 kind of way.
Yeah, it is.
It's got more production value, you know?
Yeah,
you could imagine, right, like the mountains around L.A. to be Egypt.
Bronson Canyon is Egypt, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Let's look at the cover before we get into the story itself. This is where Brave and the Bold goes to the DC 100-page spectacular format. The cover copy kind of takes over on these books.
It's a nice image. We're robbed, like you said, of the large image. I don't think this one would be overly compelling on its own as a cover. If it was just that image, but it's of course very nicely drawn because it's drawn by Jim Aparo. I will say though, we were promised a mummy and we didn't get one. Although this could pass for a mystery or horror cover at DC as well right now. You could take Mr. Miracle and Batman out and just put two normal like archaeologists in there and it could be covered a House of Mystery or House of Secrets or something.
Yeah, the sarcophagus is like the Pulp Fiction briefcase where it's glowing. So we don't know there'd be a mummy in there necessarily, but that's what you imagine from these kinds of stories. I think it would have worked as a cover, as a larger cover, because it's very moody, all the darkness in the tomb and the way the Atun character is supposed to be sort of in shadow, you know, and mysterious. I like Batman's pose. It feels very natural. I mean, it feels natural in the same way that anyone wearing this kind of outfit, like, he makes me think of the the Michael Keaton Batman with the, like, the neck is very stiff and he's has to he has to turn around in an awkward way. Yeah, it's not necessarily heroic, but I think you're right. It's kind of like one of those House of Mystery covers. But it's tiny, and then so we need to tell people that the Silent Night is in this one, so there's just no room for more. You know, it's the cost of having 60-cent, 100-page books.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting if you think about it, because the Golden Age comics were always anthology titles, unless it was like a singular, you know, Batman, which all had Batman stories, but still they had separate stories in there. But, you know, they only focused on one story on those covers. So it's kind of interesting that by the time of the 70s, they weren't willing to do that. They're like, no, we've got to show something from every story in this comic, you know, whether it's a little vignette or later as in the dollar comics era that Paul and Sean are doing on Batman Family Reunion. It's a lot of text, you know, now. But it's still pointing to Robin in Terror on the Campus or something, you know. So it's kind of interesting that the anthology book, the way that you advertise that via the cover has changed over the course of 30, 40 years.
I feel like maybe it's been inspired, at this point, it's inspired by magazines.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Magazines will tell you everything that's in there, you know.
Yeah.
And may have even a photo montage of the different features, I think. And you didn't really have that in the 40s.
No.
So maybe this is just like, this is what they think makes books sell. You got to know that these mostly reprinted stories, yeah, they're all reprinted stories, the other ones, are in there. I was joking about the Silent Night, but maybe you're going to get that Aquaman and Hawkman fan or a Green Lantern fan to pick this up, especially since Mr. Miracle was like maybe a more obscure character who just lost his series, so obviously was not extremely popular with fans, so
right,
that could be it.
Aquaman's on TV right now because Super Friends just recently came on. So
right, and Hawkman. And so, yeah, it kind of makes sense. But we can, of course, decry the lack of larger art.
Yeah.
What about the story? The lack of larger story. No, maybe there's too much story in this. I think there's too much story in this. What did you think of it overall?
It's Bob Haney. I never don't enjoy a Bob Haney story, despite the fact that we're going to poke at it. The plots are well written. I mean, there's so much plot. Like you said, there's probably too much plot in this one. I will say that things aren't really resolved, that Batman's trying to figure out in this. That's one thing I'm kind of like, at the end of the story, what about the Mastaba? You know, it's like, is it going to get taken apart and moved back to Egypt? I mean, Batman found no evidence that the sale was legal, and the Egyptian government saying it's illegal because this guy's a crook. So, and he's dead. So, yeah, more than likely that thing's coming down. So, Batman's side venture into Egypt was kind of pointless, other than he, you know, kind of sort of learned something that he doesn't really understand, and he met Mr. Miracle, which will come in handy later. So,
right. Like, there's a murder mystery that kind of takes over the story, and then that becomes the Mummy Redux or something. At the end, they're being led by Adam West told us just now that at the end, there's a mysterious, you know, doors are opening by themselves, etc. And you don't know why. It's like Atun's spirit, but Atun is alive on his planet. Okay, he's in the helmet. His consciousness, like a version of his consciousness is in the helmet, taking over Batman in this case. But by that point, they've left that helmet behind. It's like the whole pyramid, or I mean, Mastaba, taken over. What's happening?
I kind of thought that we see a hand grab the helmet. So I kind of thought Atun was there. He had went back and then they beamed him back out again. That's kind of what I got, that he was
okay,
like actually there, and he's the one opening the doors. He's probably knows where secret switches are to open the doors and everything. And then they beamed him out, and that's when they said, yeah, we let you go back. You can't go back again. And now, why did he go back at the exact time that Batman and Mr. Miracle got into the tomb? I don't know. That's another question. Why is he back then? Maybe he's just hanging out, waiting to see if somebody showed up. I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot left on the table with this story.
Now I'm seeing, okay, I'd missed that. There's so many word balloons. I missed the hand going for the helmet.
Uh-huh.
Is Ingrid still alive somehow?
Yeah. And I mean, I know there's another thing. There's another point that we'll get to as we go through kind of beat by beat that I think you and I got two different interpretations on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So yeah, it's kind of interesting that, yeah, this is, I think Haney even out Haneyed himself in this one. Yeah.
Right. Because if someone picked up the helmet, and the only other character in the tomb is Ingrid, believed dead. The hand's kind of struggling. So maybe I'm playing panel by panel here, but you know, if Ingrid is in there and she takes the helmet and she becomes a Tun, and he, through that mind, controls the entrances and so on. Okay, acceptable. If Atun has been sent back, maybe he's been reactivated because, like, the helmet has been, you know, used. He goes back. I don't know. It's like that final scene. We regret returning you again so suddenly. I think you're right. I think he was back there.
Yeah, I just don't know why.
We regret returning you again, you know?
Right.
Right. So he went back for his stuff, which he'd left in the tomb. And then they brought him back. There's no evidence anyways because the whole tomb has been destroyed. Okay. I think we're making sense of this. It takes two people to read a Bob Haney story. I completely understand. The other thing that remains unresolved is who this master was.
Oh, yeah.
Who's sending assassins and he's trying to get this. Well, he's not trying to get the secret of immortality because he's plainly dying, but his people are looking for immortality and he dies at the end. There's no coming back from that. So he's not like a continuing concern, but we don't know who he was either. So this is a very strange element.
Do you think that Haney may have just been flipping through some of the Ra's al Ghul saga? And, like, so you've got this master of this organization that, you know, wants to continue to live. And so it's kind of like almost like a Lazarus Pit kind of search type thing. And then Ingrid could be a Talia type character, but instead of coming on to Batman, she's snuggling up to Mr. Miracle. So I don't know. It kind of has a similar feel. It's almost like a alternate version Ra's al Ghul and Talia. I didn't think about that till just now. It popped in my head. I'm like, well, you know, he's got this headquarters in the Alps, which Ra's has been known to do, you know, and it's got that kind of international globetrotting flavor, which Haney was already doing even before Denny started doing it with the Ra's stories. But all of a sudden it feels like, is this kind of an alternate take on Ra's al Ghul? I don't know.
Well, we're often on what people have called Earth B.
Right.
with the Bob Haney stories. B for Bob, B for Brave and the Bold, because that's usually where it was. But either way, this could almost be a recurring feature, except that Bob Haney doesn't write every story that we cover. But you know, every time it's like, what makes this an Earth B story? And I think that's possibly one where this is sort of an alternate take on the Ra's al Ghul stuff. North Africa, everything. You know, it's very much like that. But then also, you know, sometimes the guest star is a little out of character.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I think, I don't know if Mr. Miracle is necessarily out of character so much as like maybe his background is, because I feel like Bart is a little too worried about him. She feels more of a wallflower in this. She's got like these big black gloves and is a big camera, and she's filming the escape artist act. And why isn't Oberon doing that? Or why don't they have somebody else doing that? Shiloh doing that? You know, it's always a little off. Just a little off. I mean, normal for a team-up book, because not everybody is in control of the guest character, you know, in the same way that their own writers are. So it's acceptable. I think Jim Aparo is actually the one that makes him off model, because he doesn't have like the red highlights on the face. It's just like he's got a yellow face, but he doesn't have like the red lines. And that takes a little away from him.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody can ever, except like maybe Steve Rude, I don't think anybody can really figure out how to draw Mr. Miracle's costume correctly. They're always leaving elements of it out. It's just, and I think it flummoxes people, the whole, how is it a mask, and it's like completely cut, it like almost goes inside his mouth, you know, there's no hole, it's just, he's got yellow clear up into his gums, you know, I mean, it's kind of that Batman Beyond look, you know. I think that's one thing Bruce Timm cited was the Mr. Miracle mask and the mask that Doctor Strange briefly wore in the late 60s, early 70s too, that was just that, it's supposed to be a mask, but it's really like, it's like their face, you know. Other than that, is like his costume details seem, you know, they're okay. But I noticed the colorist, at least on DC Universe Infinite, kept making his big red belt green through the whole thing. So he's just got this big, huge, he's almost like Doctor Strange with the, you know, underwear up under his ribcage look kind of going on, because his belt's green too. So
sometimes the tricks he uses, the powers he uses, feel off model to me, but
yeah, he's got the Jedi super speed from Phantom Menace that you're like, where the crap did that come from?
Right,
yeah.
A lot of super speed. Like, how does he do? It's a bit of an explanation because, you know, how does Batman just leave the room without no one noticing? How does Mr. Miracle, you know, do his escapes? And here they're saying he does it with super speed or bursts of super speed, which was never established anywhere else. So I'm going to call this an Earth B feature.
Yeah. That's Fastback. He's there. No, what's is that Fastback that's the new god with the super speed? That's him, right? Yeah. He's also the name of the turtle in the zoo crew. That's what confused me for a second. And then, of course, you got Light Ray, too. So, yeah. But, yeah, it's not Mr. Miracle. So
no, he doesn't have any powers is the thing. I mean, everything is Mother Box or tricks or, you know, technology. But the super speed stuff is like, you're pushing it. All right, let's go through the comic and do it beat by beat, as you suggested. Because we start on a page, already we're in the action, you know? It's like, this is too much plot, like we said, so we're already, you know, in a gunfight. There's a little introduction, which is, I like it. It's latest addition to the Brave and the Bold file. And it has a little file shape. And and we get to know something about the Batman and something about Mr. Miracle. Of course, there's a lot of shade being thrown. The Batman is considered by many to be the world's greatest escape artist. Okay, Mr. Miracle is in this, but then Mr. Miracle's note does not refute this.
Yeah.
I think maybe it refuted it in some version of the script, but instead it's a note on when this story takes place. So I think it's like, well, now the story doesn't make sense because Mr. Miracle isn't on Earth anymore. So we got to address that and we'll put that in the note. And I think maybe that replaced what was originally there, which is, no, Mr. Miracle is the best.
Right.
What is this?
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed like they were kind of setting up kind of a little bit more of a rivalry thing. But spoiler warning, Batman doesn't have a great showing in this one. So it might be his book, but yeah.
Yeah, we're going to correct this mistake here by showing you a story where Mr. Miracle is the best. Maybe that's it. It's also set at the Mastaba, which at first was like, wait, why is Commissioner Gordon in Egypt? Because that's what it looks like. Until we learned that this thing was brought over stone by stone and rebuilt in Gotham. But a mastaba, and no explanation as to what this is. They just used the word. And I was like, okay, let me go in and check it. Okay, it's a flat-roofed, rectangular Egyptian tomb with inward sloping sides constructed out of mud bricks or limestone. These edifices mark the burial sites of many eminent Egyptians during the early dynastic period and Old Kingdom. Non-royal use of the mastabas continued for over 1,000 years. So it's basically the precursor to the pyramids. And I guess some mastabas were eventually given pyramid roofs, from what I've read. You know, I learned something, but of course I learned something thanks to looking it up. And maybe I wouldn't have learned anything in 1974 because I didn't have Google. I had encyclopedias, probably. Also, I was 3, so I probably, you know, a bit early to learn about mastabas.
Right.
You know, when your parents sit you down at some point, tell you about mastabas, but 3 is too young for that.
There's the birds and the bees, and there's the mastaba talk. This is the kind of thing that would send you, you know, pack into the encyclopedia. The comic writers like to do that. Of course, you usually had, like, Julia Schwartz would put a little footnote or something, you know, kind of like a mastaba is a blah, 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 you know, like at least a 2 or 3 lines definition, you know. So I learned something. I you know, we're getting some other things I learned in covering this one, too. So that's fun. I always think it's funny in Brave and the Bold. I'm convinced one reason that Jim Gordon is so important in Batman's narrative nowadays was Haney's Brave and the Bold, because he featured Action Gordon as Batman's regular partner more than any other writer. He seemed much younger than the old guy who just slipped on the bat signal in many of the Batman and detective stories. Gordon was in the field. He was side by side Batman. He's in a shootout here. You know, I mean, he wasn't just sitting behind a desk waiting for him to come in the window and then leave and, you know, then be startled that he left when he wasn't looking or something. He's in it, you know, and I, you know, now we have a much younger Gordon that doesn't even have gray hair anymore in modern comics, or white or gray hair. And I think that kind of trend, you can go back to Bob Haney in his portrayal of Gordon in Brave and the Bold. And I think that's because he just needed another regular cast member for Batman to bounce off of. And so Gordon was it.
Batman feels much more like he's part of the police force in these comics.
Definitely.
In fact, you know, on the next page, he's using a gun or shotgun or something to throw a grenade. I mean, it's a special kind of gun, but it's still weird to see Batman with a gun.
Yeah, I couldn't decide. I don't like it, but as being a zany Haney thing, I kind of do like it because, oh, there's Haney again, you know, being kind of skirting the edge of what Batman shouldn't do. Yeah, it's definitely a real, it's not a real gun shooting bullets, but it's a real, like, shotgun that just happens to shoot tear gas. So it's a very real-looking gun. So it is kind of, whoa, taken aback. It's almost like the faux pas Julius Schwartz did in his first issue editing the comics where he had Batman pick up a gun that a criminal dropped and hold the criminals at gunpoint until the police got him, which got him in a lot of hot water with fans back in 1964.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's an odd visual, especially since we're seeing, like, guys brat and getting killed by cops.
Yeah.
Or at least that's what it looks like, right? It's like in that same shot, there's a guy getting a guy that's dead and a guy getting it violently.
Yeah.
And Batman is just part of the guys that are shooting in that direction. So it's off-putting. I think this is the point that we have a different interpretation.
Right.
Because I was under the impression here that these guys were not human. We're not killing guys, we're killing robots, androids, something. Did you not get that impression?
He says they're automatons, which, I mean, I get that. But the fact that Batman later says they were a Suicide Squad, which is a nice reference to a long defunct series that started in Brave and the Bold, I don't think he would say that about robots. You know, the way DC, unless it was the Metal Men, which sometimes even them, DC looked at robots back then as like, well, they're literally just there to, you know, they're just machines and you just, you know, go plow through them. That's the one thing is we can kill in these comics and not have the comics code on us. Basically, yeah, I kind of think Haney meant that they were zealots, you know, whatever, they're following the master. They, you know, they don't care about their life. They're just going to plow through a hail of bullets if it stops, if it allows the other guys to do their mission, which at that point they thought the bat statue was inside and that's why they went in. When they found out it wasn't, they blew themselves up. You know, they're kamikaze type, you know, faction that's the fanatical to whoever this master is. That's kind of what I got. Maybe they are robots. I don't know. We don't know who this master is, so he might have an advanced series of androids. The fact that her name's Borg, certainly.
I don't know if, I mean, that makes her Swedish, but...
And
Ingrid Borg, as we're going to find out, is rather cold. You know, she puts the moves on Mr. Miracle, and maybe that's the Earth-B thing where, you know, he seems interested when he's going to marry Big Barda in, right, you know, in a right couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So that's weird. But also she's like very calm and collected. The helicopter crashes and she's unmoved. You know, it made me think, okay, is she one of these automatons? But then there's no payoff on that. She gets shot. She's just a person. She happens to be a sociopath.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're throwing tear gas. Does it have any effect? It's not even clear. You know, it's like if they're robots, no, it wouldn't work. But we don't know that. Because eventually the situation ends with an explosion.
And it could have been a last-minute editorial thing where, because Apero drew guys like walking into a wall of bullets, the comics code might have frowned upon it and they changed the blurb that called them automatons to kind of put it in your head, well, maybe these guys aren't human. You know, that could be part of it too, because you're dealing in... We're kind of getting out of the heaviest of the comics code in the 70s, obviously, where they've let monsters loose. By this point, drug references are now okay because of the Stan Lee and then the Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill drug issues. But it could be a comic code interference thing, too.
And, of course, we're going to get into the Egyptian mystery and the bat god. Because, of course, there's got to be a bat regardless, yeah, you know. Even this lore has a bat-related thing. Which, later, we'll see, like, there's a bat sculpture and all of this. But then there's no bat motif in the story otherwise.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. Although Haney does like to put bat gods into his stories and have Batman be confronted by an ancient Batman, because he did it again later in World's Finest number 255. So he likes that trope of, oh, there was a Batman before Batman type thing, you know, which other writers do too. But he likes to set it way back in the past. So.
Right. And maybe it's a sort of foreshadowing that Atun is actually Batman.
Mm-hmm.
In the story or in part of the story. This is another element that's just like thrown in to this big mix. Page 5 is when we're, first we're introduced to the master, was just a prone figure on a surgical table. Am I the only one who got like vibes of Blofeld's clinic in on Her Majesty's Secret Service with that villain lair in the Alps?
There's some Bondian stuff going on here, and particularly that one. Yeah, definitely.
So Blofeld is the master.
Yeah, there you go.
And then, yes, here we go. Eiffel Tower, a big escape. Eventually, we'd have like those David Copperfield specials, you know, where he's disappearing the Statue of Liberty. Mr. Right. Miracle is kind of that guy in the DC universe.
Yeah.
And he meets Borg, and that's, yeah.
If you got Bart at home, one, why would you, you know, who cares? And two, if you got Bart at home, wouldn't you be fearing for your life if you were looking at another woman? I mean,
it seems dangerous, right? And then we hit part two, page 7, and that this guy, this detective from the Egyptian government, Saeed, he's the one that pushes Batman to go to Egypt and check this out. As soon as Batman gets there, he finds the criminal dead. Saeed is right behind him.
Mm-hmm.
Did he seem shady to you? Like, he's the guy that's sort of manipulating, but at the same time, if he sends Batman to Egypt, and then he's the one that's pushing him to find Atun's tomb, but he disappears from the story. It's like he wasn't shady, was he? No, because right?
Yeah. Well, I kept waiting to see if he was involved with the master. Like, you know, get Batman to do our dirty work. He's supposed to be this great detective, this great escape artist. Let him find his way into the tomb and we'll follow him while, you know, she's working. I mean, that would have made perfect sense.
Because she does. That's how they get there, right?
Right. Ingrid's working on Mr. Miracle and Saeed's working on Batman, and they're both like, okay, one of these guys is bound to get in. They're the greatest escape artists. Batman's a great detective. Mr. Miracle has, I don't know if people know he has alien technology, but he does. They might know that. So, you know, if they're both working together, it's like, well, whichever one of us gets in first, that, you know, that's great. It doesn't matter as long as we find the cure for the master, you know. But yes, Saeed just disappears, but it is very strange that he seems so important to the plot and then just disappears. And I don't think Haney reuses him. He's been known to reuse some characters and famously not other characters who seem pretty important, like Batman's godson who never reappears. I was kind of waiting for something there. And plus, I just got to say, how could a museum move a huge ancient building from Egypt without running it past the authorities before all this started? I mean, how does that happen? How does the Egyptian government not step in and say, hey, what are you doing with that ancient tomb? Taking it apart brick by brick or stone by stone or whatever. You know, that's kind of like a little far-fetched even for a comic, you know? So,
because if this were true, if Saeed was with the master, then you might have had, like on the next page, when there's the sandstorm and there's assassin who tries to kill Batman there, who equally comes out of nowhere. What if he had been revealed to be Saeed?
Yeah, exactly.
And then Batman thinks, oh.
Right. Yeah, I was a little confused at first if Batman's guide on the camel was the assassin, like he decided to. He was going to bring Batman out into the desert and kill him, and then he figured, well, okay, the sandstorm is the perfect time. And then he turned on him or something. But I don't guess it is. I guess his guide is just out wandering the desert somewhere. And when the sandstorm clears, I guess.
Right. He also disappears from the story. Unless he was the killer, which isn't clear. Could be. I mean, yeah. The colors. There's
The colors are different. But
are they that different?
He's got the same outfit on. But I mean, it's central casting. It's Hollywood. You know, you're out in the desert costuming, you know.
Like on the assassin, the tunic is sort of a pinkish. And then on the guy on the camel, also pinkish?
Yeah, it's kind of more of a gray on the DC Universe app.
The original has it. There's a pinkish wash on him.
Okay.
Maybe that's the inference?
Maybe, yeah. I don't know. It's another question. You know, it does show maybe that we see a camel, like the silhouette of a camel in the background, and it looks like maybe somebody's still on top of him. So that might be the guide. And then this guy's walking away from that, so maybe they're not the same guy.
No, I would say they are the same guy. Okay, now I'm looking at this picture, and we'll put this all up at fireandwaterpodcast.com so you can dissect it on your own. but that shot, third panel, the camel, a dromedary, really, you can see the hump, and then there's like this, I mean, on my copy, brown figure with a sword out.
Okay. Yeah, he's pink on mine.
That guy has jumped off the camel, and he's racing towards Batman, and then he's the one who attacks him.
Or it could be, see, the way I'm looking at it, he's got the hump, but it also looks like there's something beyond the hump, so maybe the guy's still sitting on the camel, and this guy's just kind of walking past them, in between them in the sandstorm, and they can't see him because of the sandstorm. It's even bending Batman's ears over. It's so strong, which I think's hilarious.
Right. Well, we got sand in our eyes, so you look at it, folks, and you tell us what you think is happening in this moment.
Read this comic book and tell us what the crap we just read, will you, please? I mean, we're obviously very confused. Are they robots, not robots? Who's the assassin? Who's Saeed? Who's the master? You know, who's Ingrid Borg? You know, all this stuff. Why in the world is, where's Barda when we need her? Why can't Batman use his utility belt to get out of some of these things? You know, things like that. I don't know.
Where, you know, is Batman boiling alive in full costume on top of a camel in the desert. You know?
Right, right. Hey, at least he didn't put on his BVS, desert gear, you know, with the trench, which I think that's the most ridiculous looking outfit Batman's ever worn. Everybody's like, oh, it's so cool. It's like, he's got his costume on underneath a freaking trench coat and all that crap. I think it's stupid looking. I'm sorry. I just think it's stupid.
Hot takes by Chris Franklin.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, like, this assassin dies by his own, he falls off a cliff.
Yeah.
And then later, Ingrid is shot by her own bullet. So, like, they don't want our heroes to be killers. You know? They always go like, oh, well, somebody died on my shift, but also I didn't do it.
Yeah.
They did it to themselves.
I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you.
Right. I mean, it's a sandstorm. Things happen. You know, you shoot something in a closed environment. Bullets bounce off sandstone, I guess. You know?
Right.
I don't know. So, like, both villains kind of... And then the master dies from natural causes. And, he's taken out. But our heroes are... Their souls are clean. Then there's, like, Batman enters the thing. So, do you like Batman as an archaeologist, an Indiana Jones-type character? Does that fit him?
I like them mixing it up. You know, I think people that say, oh, Batman's got to stay in Gotham all the time. It's like, who decided that? You know, it's like Batman was off, you know, chasing a vampire in one of his earliest stories off to Eastern Europe, you know, chasing the monk. So Batman's been globetrotting since almost the beginning of his stories. So that does not bother me one bit. I mean, when they make Batman so uber obsessed about, you know, Gotham, then yeah, you kind of like, would he really leave Gotham that long for something like that? I think there's stories that push it. Like, I think Son of the Demon, like he's off for like, 6 months or something, just gone, you know, becoming Ra's al Ghul's son-in-law, you know, I mean, basically taking over the family business in that story. And I mean, it's great for what it is. It unfortunately gave us Damien, but, you know, there's things like that to kind of push it. But yeah, I don't mind Batman. And yeah, obviously we do jail. UCAS, so we cover Justice League Unlimited. Batman's out in space. You know, he's on different planets and things. I don't mind those stories. I don't want Batman doing that all the time. I think an occasional trip around the world or off world is fun. You can make it work without destroying the mystique of Batman. And I mean, he's still got the, you know, because Aparo's drawing it, because at this point Haney is leaned into the, you know, he still has Batman walking around in broad daylight often, and like he does here, he's in broad daylight during the shootout, but he's still got that kind of, you know, grim Avenger of the night kind of persona in place. So he, you know, it's not like some of the 50s early 60s sci-fi stuff got a little too, it was too much just all the time. You know, they never turned the faucet off. But if you, you know, turn it on every once in a while, I think it's fun and it breaks things up.
Finding tombs and following clues. It's all following clues. It works with a detective character. Like, you know, Indiana Jones is a detective character.
Right, yeah.
It's just, he's detecting the past, you know, historians as detectives. So we go from the bat reflection in the water to, of course, now it turns Egyptian, the Ankh. He finds his way into this tomb fairly easily, almost drowns, but, you know, fairly easily.
If this was later in the series, I'd assume our next issue guest was Dr. Fate.
Like if these stories bled into one another, yeah.
Right.
Back to Mr. Miracle, because now we're going to lose Batman for a while, for a good while. He sees something glimmer ahead and we kind of forget about him. Mr. Miracle and Ingrid are inside the tomb. She's got some rubbings, very rude, but she's got some rubbings that tell the story of Atun, etc. And I see that in the flashback, which I can only imagine is Mr. Miracle imagining this. So if he's wrong, it makes sense. He's not from Earth. But there's like, there's pyramids in the background, which we established earlier. Went to the encyclopedia. There shouldn't be any pyramids in these early, this early dynasty. You know, it's, right. it's something that developed later before they figured out how to make triangular roofs over things. So it should be like a mastaba in the back or something. But establishes we're in Egypt. And this whole story of this guy who showed up mysteriously, had these powers, became a pharaoh, and disappeared in a beam of light. And we're going to go through that mystery. And then a bunch of death traps. They're going to meet Atun.
Right. And I think that was a good time to bring up. I had to look up. Is Atun a real pharaoh or what? It says, I looked up Atum with an M, or Atum or Tem, is an early Egyptian deity. And much of their religion and mythology is said to have come from him. So did Haney change this on purpose to avoid offending anyone, or did they just goof and change the M to an N? Comics are weird about things like this. They skirt the edges of it being based on something real, then they change a couple of letters, sometime for no apparent reason. I don't know.
It may be that, or it may just be that different sources have different spellings. I mean, obviously, yeah. This wasn't spelled. It must sound something like that, but it was like a hieroglyphic. There's no spelling of it, like phonetics for it.
Right.
Whatever book on Egypt that Bob Haney was using, the mastabas and the tembolinis and all of this, maybe that's how it was spelled.
Maybe.
Gloss in translation, I don't think he cared too much about the details.
Right. I mean, Hotep means peace and contentment. But I bet Haney is pulling the name from Imhotep, Boris Karloff's character in the original 1932 Mummy. So,
right. Does it sound Egyptian? And that's, yes. That's what he cares about here, you know. For
right.
Like, Bob Haney was clear about this, that he felt that comics were a disposable medium.
Yes.
You just write your stories. There's little kids reading this. Move on to the next one. He wasn't thinking of it necessarily as art. What he managed to do was a kind of pop art that is more comics-y than many comics. You know,
like
the same way I feel about Jack Kirby, that he was like super comics-y in a way that is that becomes pop art. Mm-hmm. I think Bob Haney was there as well, but with less intent.
Yeah, I think because Haney wasn't a fanboy, he didn't take things so seriously. You know, different things. I've been reading Michael Urie's Team-Up Companion, which is a great book, and I finally got a copy of that. Thanks to Paul Keen, who told me it was on sale at Tomorrow, so thanks, Paul. But, you know, Haney basically, like, he kind of looked down his nose a little bit at, like, older fanboys still reading comics and making deals out of continuity. He was just kind of like, really? You know, So yeah, I think you're right. I think he looks at it as like, it sounds Egyptian, we're in Egypt, just roll with it, kids. It's a story, you know, that type of thing. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, make it exciting. You know, we meet Atun. Foreshadowing, the helmet kind of has these little ears. It's maybe more of a cat than a bat, but nevertheless, there's like when Batman had like the shortest ears possible, kind of on the side in the Golden Age. Maybe it relates back to that bat god stuff that doesn't otherwise relate. And maybe it's supposed to tell us, hey, this is Batman, guys, even though maybe he's colored differently than normal.
Is he colored different in the original? That's what I was wanting to ask.
No, he's orange. Yeah, you're right. He's like, I hadn't really noticed it in the sense that I thought, oh, maybe like there's like a weird glow and there's a lot of shadows because that the Ankh, which should have been a bat, or is Bob Haney like saying the Ankh has little wings like a bat and that's how it connects?
Maybe.
I don't know. Did Jim Aparo decide that it was going to be Ankhs? But maybe Bob Haney was suggesting that it would be like a bat on the scepter.
Yeah.
Unknown. But the scepter is glowing and there's a lot of shadows coming off of it. And I thought, this is just like the color, the amber glow of the Ankh. But later, he's this strange color, and we see the aliens are this color.
Right.
So the helmet is turning you, at least your skin tone, into that alien amber.
Yeah. As soon as Mr. Miracle breaks the spell of the helmet, Batman's back to being his usual Caucasian flesh again. It's like the disappearing eye makeup seconds before Michael Keaton unmasks and Batman returns, you know? So.
Yeah. So again, I mean, this is like now the colorist doing this. Who knows? Obviously, Miss Miracle doesn't recognize him or anything. Neither do we, thanks to art. You know, like this, if this were a TV show or a movie, we would know. If it was live action, we would know. That's
Adam West in orange makeup. What?
Right. You know. Right. Unless you kept him really in shadow, there's a hint of that here, like the shadowed eyes and so on. Probably right. You'd have to push that and not recognize either the voice or the look, but Mr. Miracle certainly doesn't here. And then, you know, Ingrid steals the scepter and they're off running, lots of death traps. Mr. Miracle, super speed. Like, she reveals herself as a villain. She shoots herself by trying to shoot Mr. Miracle. And he's going to go into the center chamber and find Batman's uniform in the sarcophagus, which is like the surprise of the cover. Defeat this version of Atun and free Batman. More death traps. There's a lot of death traps in this. They get to the solar boat. Is that what we call it?
Yeah.
And my question about the solar boat, this is obviously the craft that Atun came to Earth with. These aliens, as we find out, have interstellar beaming capability. They can teleport people across interstellar space. Why do they need spacecraft?
Right, yeah. I mean, Sardath, he thought he was Mr. Hotshot for inventing the Zeta Beam, but clearly these guys beat him by several millennia, you know, so...
yeah.
Adam Strange has got nothing on this beam, you know. So.
So at first I thought maybe you, when you beam, you can't bring stuff with you.
Yeah, okay.
Because the first time he leaves, the scepter and the helmet are left behind.
Right.
But if, as we've, you know, detected here, he comes back and gets his helmet back, well, does he? I beam in, I put the helmet on. Okay, I see what's going on. I save these people. I destroy the tomb. I get beamed back. The helmet.
It may have disintegrated when it came outside like the ship and the scepter did.
Oh, right. That's right. The scepter just like turned to dust, which right. may also be a command that Atun came back to deliver so it doesn't get into the wrong hands. Okay.
Yeah, that seems like humans aren't ready for...
No, we're not ready. It seems to me that maybe like a Bob Haney story, we said, you know, you need to be two or three to read a Bob Haney story correctly. You also need to debate it endlessly.
Yeah, apparently.
That's quite the trick, that you can write a comic that is perfectly fun and you read it once and you're happy with the story because you kind of forget. Podcasters will go in and dissect it and notice things that because they're on like their third pass and they're taking notes, and that's not how you read comics normally. But then when somebody does do that, put a microscope on it. Okay, no, actually it does work. It's like there's a lot of inference and they're not telling us everything. But when you read it back, it's like, no, the clue was there. It makes sense to the people who made it, but they didn't explain everything.
Right. And if wherever Bob Haney is in the cosmos, and if he's on the source wall, wherever he's at, he's rolling his eyes at us right now for...
For caring this much, right?
Right, exactly. You should be go out having adventures like real men. Grow a beard, boys. Jeez, you know.
Hey, you were an adult writing these. You know, we all share in the...
I didn't think this when I first read it, but after I got to doing the notes, again, like you said, once we started like dissecting it, I'm like, okay, this is pretty zany for... I know we say zany Haney. This is pretty zany for Haney, some of these things in here. It's not, you know, it doesn't seem so on the surface, but it's kind of funny because I think Batman and Mr. Miracle, when they meet in the Justice League crossover, they know each other. They team up in that story like they're friends. And then with Batman in the JLI, you know, Batman seems like comfortable around Scott and like he treats him a little bit better than he does some of the, you know, the other teammates there, like he's a peer, you know. So this might take place on Earth B, but it's also somehow overlapping into Earth 1 and post-crisis Earth 2, because I think these count as the foundation for Batman and Scott being kind of, you know, being friendly.
I think what we call zany is an interest in surprising the reader. Let's put things in the story that you're not expecting.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, Egyptian tombs or what we think is like a non sequitur is also a surprise and kind of delightful. That's how Haney was coined as zany. Then who fared better? How well does this fit either of the stories or atmospheres of the comics? Is this a Batman story, or is it more of a Mr. Miracle story, Chris?
Considering Batman disappears for a good chunk of it and is duped through that period, I personally think we have to give this one to Scott.
It's not as clear to me, I gotta say. Egypt, desert landscapes, It's far from Gotham, but it's also Ra's al Ghul, and it fits O'Neill's international Batman. At the same time, feels kind of far from a Mr. Miracle comic. You know, it's really not what Mr. Miracle was doing either. So if Batman wasn't so absent in the middle of the book, I would give it to him. I can't, you know, it's like right. Batman is forgotten for too long, so it's got to be a Mr. Miracle story.
Well, maybe this one's actually pretty well balanced then, you know, in some ways.
Yeah, in some ways. It's also about escapes and, you know, and both characters do share that. Okay, let me ask this question that we only ask on the Brave and the Bold segment. Do they know Batman's secret identity? You're the expert.
Well, he might not know his name, but he's certainly seen his face after, you know, he lost his tan. So, and considering Scott lives in the world of entertainment, it probably wouldn't take too much for him to connect that face to Bruce Wayne, because I mean, I'm sure he's been at charity balls and events, and you know, and I don't can't recall if I know most of the Justice League International later didn't know Batman was Bruce Wayne. In fact, he disguised himself as Bruce Wayne on a mission and in that one storyline with him and fire and everything. So I don't know if Scott, certainly Martian Manhunter knew he was Bruce Wayne, but beyond him, I don't think anybody on the team knew. So I don't know. At this point, I don't think he knows, but he's certainly seen his face and he can put two and two together.
And if we ever cover any of the other Brave and the Bold with Mr. Miracle, there might be an answer in there. We'll see. Cool moves. What was Batman's coolest move?
I don't think Batman had a cool move in this story. Really, the closest we got is Batman acting like a detective and finding the entrance to the tomb, which, you know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, how about fighting an assassin in a sandstorm?
Okay, that's pretty cool, too.
Yeah. Mr. Miracle's coolest move, since he's the big hero here.
I think using his mother box circuitry to blast a Toon's helmet and free Batman's mind. I mean, he saves Batman, the star of the book. So I think that's pretty cool. Even maybe that's not something Mother Box should be able to do. I'm not sure.
I'm going to go with him piloting the alien craft out of the collapsing tomb as the cliff face comes down. It's a big action moment. So Scott Free or Batman? Who was the coolest in this issue?
I think it's definitely Scott.
Yeah.
Batman's off his game big time in this one. And like I said, it's his book. But, you know, they gave it to Mr. Miracle. I mean, it's pretty good to have an outing this good after a month after your books got canceled. So,
Yeah. Pirate victory.
Right.
Dumb or weird moves? Batman's?
Well, not pulling his rebreather out of his belt after firing tear gas is pretty dumb, but the winner is Bat Sense. Bat Sense? Was Haney moonlighting at Marvel under a pseudonym and got his characters confused? Although he does mention it in the issue before, the famous Batman-Joker team-up. So, second runner-up is him putting on that helmet in the first place. But, yeah, he's Batman's, again, not his best, but yeah, Bat Sense. My bat sense is tingling. You know.
Yeah, Mr. Miracle also has a mother box sense. This is a part of this story. They're both going like, don't go there. I feel something. And maybe it's just like the telepathy of the Atun helmet or something. But
where's the pings? Where's the ping, 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 ping from mother box when it's supposed to be doing something?
We're missing the pings. Earth B, no pings. Curiosity killed the bat. You know, it's like we put on the helmet. What are you doing, Batman? Probably telepathically controlled to do so.
Yeah, maybe.
Mr. Miracle's dumbest move.
Like I said before, if I had a woman like Bart at home, I wouldn't go off following a leggy blonde. I don't care. I'd take Barta with me. You know, like, come on, Barta, you're coming with me.
Right. I mean, super strength would have been coming useful in this. So yes. I agree. Scott or Batman, dumbest in the issue?
It's Batman hands down. In fact, Scott is probably thinking, I heard this Batman guy was the best of the best, but he's a dope.
Well, especially like he gets himself into trouble. He's sort of, for Doctor Who fans, the second Doctor was always going, oh, I want that hat. And he was always wearing these fanciful hats. And I think Patrick Troughton was just like loving to put hats on.
Okay, yeah.
They made it part of the character. He improvised some bits there or something, but it's like Batman sees this big honking helmet. So, I want to try that hat on. It's like, what?
When one of your arch enemies is Jervis Tetch, don't go putting weird hats on, you know?
Good point. Good point. So the friendly farewell. So the story cuts them off in mid-discussion. He goes, any guesses, Batman? And there's no answer because we cut to the Alps and we cut to the other planet. But it does end on a note of admiration from Batman. You know, Scott being very honest and not taking the credit for the escape. So that's nice as well. you know, I feel like there's certainly respect between them.
Yeah, like I said, I always got the feeling that Batman and Mr. Miracle jihad pretty well, you know, so like even later team ups and Justice League crossovers and on the team later, I always kind of felt like Scott was one of the guys Batman trusted on the team to like actually have his head out of his butt at any given moment. So, you know, he wasn't Booster and Beetle, you know, so
no, he was part of that. They tried to make them a trio, but Mr. Miracle was the more reasonable of the three.
He's the older brother that's, you know, off to college and more level-headed type, you know, yeah.
I mean, he was the married guy of the group, you know. All right, we'll take a break for a couple of promos. We'll be back with our special features.
Just imagine the mightiest heroes of our time.
All of them on one team.
Since there are so many of us, we have a chance to do more than just put out fires. We can be proactive. We can do some real good in the world.
JLU Cast brings you coverage of Justice League Unlimited, the ultimate gathering of DC's heroes and villains, and the culmination of the greatest interpretation of the DC Universe ever.
Join Chris and Cindy Franklin as they relive the team-ups, the battles, the conspiracies.
I had no idea that the Girl Scouts were responsible for the crop circle phenomenon.
Few people do. Few even think to ask the question.
The romance and the fun.
A head start. You're getting soft in your old age.
Don't you have a tall building to go leap?
And the adventure continues.
Find us wherever fine Fire and Water podcasts are available.
Coming soon from Amalgam Comics, in this month's issue of Fourth Worlds Unknown, the 90s are back, and so is Miracle Lock. The cybernetic new god has been slumming it in the future where suburbia has taken over everything. But when he's kidnapped by Bedlam the Slayer and brought to the age of grunge and jacket-wearing heroes, things will never be the same. A new but nostalgic era begins at Amalgam Comics, and this time, there may be no escape.
We're back. Our monthly feature, as you know, is the bonus team-up in which each of us proposes, in this case, a perfect Mr. Miracle team-up. What do you got?
How cool would it be to have Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., recruit Mr. Miracle for an impossible mission? Since Fury's best stories were created by Jim Steranko, who was a real escape artist, and the inspiration for Jack Kirby's creation of Mr. Miracle. There's quite a bit of suave Steranko in the secret agent version of Fury, but there are elements of Kirby in both the cigar-chomping war veteran Fury and in Mr. Miracle, especially his relationship with Barda based on Kirby's relationship with his wife, Roz. I can't think of a better team-up. I want to see this like right now.
I'm not going to do better. I love it. But I think I want to see Mr. Miracle team up with Michael Chabon's Escapist, who is based on him, on Mr. Miracle. You know, springing from the pages of the seminal novel about comics creators from the Golden Age, golden through Silver Age, The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, the Escapist actually went on to have comics made about him. And now I want to see him meet his inspiration in a book where both of them escape convention and story logic so that it can happen.
Nice. That's a good one too. Yeah. Let's have both of these. Let's just do it. You know, Marvel and DC are talking again, so we can get the Steranko. I don't know if we can get Steranko. It'd be great if Steranko was involved. He's still around, obviously. Could get him involved, get that, get the Escapist and Mr. Miracle too. Let's do it. I'd read them.
Let's escape. So, okay, who's brave and bold next? This is an indexing show, but it jumps around as inspired by the issue we're looking at now. So every episode, we'll explain the thematic logic between this episode's guest and the next. So Chris, where to now and how do you get us there?
Okay, this issue, Batman solved a mystery written on an ancient bat statue, which unlocked a secret from ancient Egypt. In our next issue, Batman also follows a found artifact with a bat motif, which leads him to travel back in time to the U.S. Civil War and meet the Scalp Hunter. It's by Jerry Conway and Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
From Brave and the Bold, number 171.
Okay. And that's going to make it really hard for me on the next loop. I don't think there's any other Brave and the Bold with a Western star.
No, they didn't. They surprisingly never did Batman and Jonah Hex, which is insane because Jonah Hex was really popular back then.
I've got my work cut out for me, but I do love these insane crossovers that you never think would work or should happen. So I'm looking forward to it in 4 months. Okay, now it's time for your feedback on our previous episode, Together, in which we covered Brave and the Bold number 195, starring Batman and I, Vampire. Let me start with Isamu Yukinori. He says, I believe the vampire mosquito from Africa Uncle Siskoid had mentioned is called the Adzi, which takes the form of a quasi-firefly. I could not find an image on Google that matched the illustration you described from your book. All right, Isamu, there's also an even chance that it's a false memory, combining a bunch of monsters in that book or others and monster manuals and stuff like that. I've got such a big collection of this kind of nonsense. In fact, I found the book and I looked into it and I couldn't find the mosquito vampire that I was sure was there. So there is a pretty cool vampiric war elephant in there to represent the African continent, but not the fly. So I'm thinking, honestly, maybe some Dungeons and Dragons manual is probably where I took that and then confounded the two things.
Okay, now I got to see this were elephant thing. I mean, that's vampiric were elephant. That's insane. I got to see that now.
Okay, I'll take a picture and send it to you because we're friends.
Appreciate it. Speaking of friends, Martin Gray wrote in, I read I, Vampire from the start, so it was a treat to see him honored with a side trip to Brave and the Bold. I found your dissection and discussion thoroughly engaging, Siskoid and Chris. It was a fun issue, even if the Doctor did look too much like Jim Gordon. But he didn't look like action Jim Gordon. That's the difference. He's in Brave and the Bold. Mm. He's action Jim Gordon. Siskoid, a fair view of the House of Mystery stories on DC Infinite right into the Bruce Jones era. They're worth a read, even for a non-vampire fan. Yeah, I read quite a bit of those before we did this last one. I reread them. I read them before. But by the way, Murray wasn't Andrew's wife. She was his lover. It doesn't make a huge difference, but there you go.
And then Bucky749 provides his idea for a team up between iVampire and the manga series D. Greyman. As usual, I have no idea what this is.
That's a new one on me. I know who Vampire Hunter D is, but that's about it. Might be a sequel series or something. Dr. Ange writes in, as I have said on other shows and in other message boards, DC Comics Presents and Brave and the Bold were sort of who's who before that book existed. These books were where I learned about the corners of the DCU. I definitely had this book from off the rack back in the day, but it has been lost to the limbo of lost books. It's with all your lost socks, probably. Really glad you both mentioned the coloring of the book and how important it was to the storytelling here. Kudos to Adrian Roy for getting it right. Yeah, I don't think Adrian Roy gets enough credit for Bronze Age comics in the color, the mood she brought via her coloring. So anytime we get to trumpet her horn, I know I did it when Ryan and I were doing a Nightcast. Anytime I can fly Adrian Roy's flag, I will do so because she was just great.
And then we have Tim Price as well. That creative team looks familiar somehow, says the guy covering Batman and the Outsiders here. Yes, Adrian Roy is a treasure, I fully admit. I often don't give the coloring enough attention because part of this job is not to draw attention away from the story, but learning to pay attention has elevated my appreciation of stories. And Adrienne does some amazing things in her comics. Plus, she was a machine. I count 8 comics colored in the same month as this issue, but also routinely coloring 10 per month in the same era. Phenomenal output. I do agree that Barr's take on Batman is harsher than others at this time. I haven't done enough research yet to see if this was always how Barr wrote him, or if he was ahead of the trend that would become the norm following Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. But also, Barr would show Batman's softer side too, with smiles, jokes, and affection. His Batman wasn't a one-note character.
Yeah, I always cite that, like, that there's that great, we talked about Ra's al Ghul a lot, there's that great Batman annual, I'm missing the issue number out of the top of my head, but it's like when they first come back to the annuals in the early 80s, and it's Mike W. Barr writing and Trevor Von Eden on art. It's a really great book, and basically Batman kind of lets Ra's al Ghul die in that, you know, because he always does that with Ra's, like we joked about earlier, but, and then Talia's kind of mad at him, and Robin's like, you lost the girl, but you saved the city, Batman, isn't that enough? And he's like, it's everything, let's go, chum. He calls him chum, you know, so it's like semi-murderous Batman, but also Adam Westy, old chum with Robin. So I love that. He's like synthesized Batman, you know? Rob McCarthy writes in, it would be really strange if Andrew Bennett was not inspired by Dark Shadows. I don't remember many other vampires having such detailed backstories as Andrew Bennett / Barnabas Collins. I definitely think there had to be some. I mean, I would have to ask JMD Mateus, like, in person, like, were you inspired by Dark Shadows? I don't know if anybody's ever asked him that, but I've always got that vibe. I think any semi-heroic vampire owes something to Barnabas Collins, at least in modern times. Most vampires were pretty loathsome pre-Barnabas Collins, so even later versions of Dracula.
Chris Pine says, I like that vampires run undercover sting operations for victims. I also enjoyed how this issue avoided the typical Marvel fight before the team-up. Bennett basically says, yo, I'm cool, and Batman takes a second and replies, we should work together because I am also cool. I'm just saying that's a lot of trust being extended to a vampire from the 1500s.
Batman's seen some stuff by this point.
Yeah, he's pre-Barnabas, so watch out. All right, well, that's the bottom of the mailbag. Thanks for teaming up with me, Chris. Tell people what else you're working on at the moment.
Well, first, before we do that, I have to address something, and I didn't put this in the notes, so Cisco was probably like, oh, God, what's he going to say? No, because our friend Shag has made a competition out of the different segments on FW Team Up, and he, of course, hosts the Marvel Team Up segments, I just want to say to all the listeners here, let's beat Shag. Let's leave your comments. Tell us what you think about this story. We got plenty of questions that you can help us answer. Are they robots in this story? Who's the master? Was Ingrid a robot? What was the deal with Atun? Was he there? Was he not there? There's so many things left unanswered in this story after we dissected it. So you let us know what you think. But most importantly, leave more comments than you do for Marvel Team Up. Because if Shag's going to make this a competition, I'm going to whoop his ass. So let's do it. And Brave and the Bold is the original Team Up comic, guys. All these, no offense, Cisco, but all these other comics you're covering, they're ripoffs of the Brave and the Bold with just other characters plugged in instead of Batman. So let's make Brave and the Bold the top because it's the original Team Up book, if you don't count World's Finest, and it deserves to have the most comments on the network. Meanwhile, Cindy and I are teaming up with some special guests to cover the final season of Justice League Unlimited on JLUcast, and I got a few guest appearances coming up on the networks as well. We'll be dropping by the embassy to guest with Shag, I'm still friends with him despite all this, on his JLI Bois podcast and discuss an animated series that has a lot in common with the series you and I cover here, Siskoid, so there's a big clue. Plus, I'll be going back to Gotham to join the Dynamite duo Paul and Sean on Batman Family Reunion soon, so I'm all over the place.
All right, a reminder that we do have a Patreon, so if you like this content and want more like it, please think about making a monthly or one-time donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards. Check it out at patreon.com/FWPodcast. This month, we're proud to team up with our sponsor, Alan W. Wright, the Bold Outlaw. We do enjoy reading your thoughts. It's not a competition for me, anyway, because I'm on each of these segments. But watch out. Shag is really tricky. Like last time, he didn't have the most comments. He had the most people commenting. So don't leave multiple comments in the hopes of helping Chris here. That won't work for Shag. It's got to be more comments by more people. Right. And then probably you'll have you'll do a word count or something and you'll find a way to win.
Probably so.
But if you want to do that. Yeah. If you want to do that, please. It's fireandwaterpodcast.com. Because we're not necessarily finding every, you know, social media outlet. And if somebody said something there, it's got to be on the site. So please visit fireandwaterpodcast.com and leave your comment in that section. We'll read those comments on this issue when Chris is back with us. But next month, I'll be here with our friend Ryan Daly as we continue his coverage of Marvel 2-in-1 with issue 27 of that title. So on that, see you next time for another amazing superhero team-up, because after all, justice
is a team effort.
Chum.